First, they held their own. But with Crook's arrival, the tide began to turn. Crook viewed the Apaches as tenacious tigers who could only be brought to bay by unconventional means, including the employment of Indian scouts. He maintained that to polish a diamond, one had to resort to diamond dust. For this reason, he soon enlisted 44 Apache men from the White Mountain, Ararapia, and Sibiku bands as key components in his operational plan. These men, he contended, understand thoroughly what is expected of them and know best how to do their work. Their best quality is their individuality. Among these enlistees were Pedro, Miguel, Diablo, Alchise, Peton, Machol, Blanket, Chiquito, and Nochaldelclin, known to the whites as Bobby Declinney. Bobby subsequently left scouting to become a religious healer, his beliefs eventually stirring up unrest that ended in the tragic Battle of Sibiku. This clash, however, was nearly a half dozen years in the future. For the present, Alchise and his fellow scouts, commanded by the 23rd U.S. Infantry Captain George M. Randall, with civilian scout Cordon Cooley, who was related to Alchise through marriage, deployed alongside cavalrymen with a vengeance. During the winter of 1872 and 1873, Randall's strike force combed the countryside. On March 27, 1873, their efforts produced results. At dawn, horse soldiers and scouts struck an enemy rancheria at Turret Mountain, taking the inhabitants by surprise. A short, sharp exchange ended with many of the villagers dead, some of whom even hurled themselves off the cliff to avoid capture. In fact, only 15 survived to be taken as prisoners. Just under a month later, on April 25, 1873, Randall's contingent fell upon another band, one led by Delche, whom Crook dubbed the Liar. After locating Delche's camp near the headwaters of Canyon Creek, it took Randall only a few shots to convince the surrounded men, women, and children to give up rather than suffer the fate of the unfortunate Turret Mountain group. They reluctantly marched off to Camp Apache. Crook enthusiastically wrote his superiors about the role played by the scouts. On June 30, 1873, he sought medals of honor for 10 of them. More than 2 years passed before the War Department responded in the affirmative. Alchise was among the prestigious cadre, all of whom had been cited for gallant conduct during the different campaigns against and engagements with the Apaches during the winter of 1872-1873. Bravery does not always coincide with perfect conduct, as the actions of Medal of Honor holder Alchise attested. A day after his second of many enlistments, the now veteran scout decided he had business elsewhere. He disappeared until September of 1873. Although he was listed as a deserter during his months of absence, Alchise's voluntary surrender brought no punitive actions. In line with Crook's rather paternalistic views, the general recommended leniency for minor offenses committed by Indians. Word came from departmental headquarters that Alchise was to be restored to duty without trial to serve out his enlistment as a private. This incident of AWOL did not mar Alchise's military prospects because he was appointed to a sergeant even after his unauthorized absence from duty. Indeed, when under Crook's 1873 orders that each soul residing on the reservations be assigned an individual tag with a letter and number identifying their band and themselves, Pedro's people were designated as Band A. Alchise received tag A1. Clearly, government officials acknowledged his important status at this early stage. Nevertheless, as with many confined to the reservation, there were peaks and valleys for Alchise, but he managed to stay relatively aloof of serious problems for several years after he left the scouts. That proved true until 1881, when former fellow scout Nochaldelclin shared his vision of a world without whites. He preached the resurrection of Apache dead, who, along with the living, would drive out the white invaders. His teachings, somewhat akin to the ghost dance at Pine Ridge in 1890-91, a decade later, fomented fears of an outbreak at the San Carlos Agency. Whether true or not, Crook's replacement in Arizona ordered Colonel Eugene A. Carr at Fort Apache to send elements of the 6th U.S. Cavalry with the express purpose of either capturing or killing the prophesizing Holy Man. Carr obeyed, taking Nachi Del Cline into custody. This arrest proved a violent backlash. A number of Apaches attacked Carr's column as they headed back to the post. During the firefight, some of the scouts went over to the Apache side. When the fighting ceased, 6 of Carr's men were dead, as was Nachi Del Cline and an unknown number of his supporters. Returning to Fort Apache on August 13, 1881, the garrison withstood a brief siege before reinforcements arrived. In the aftermath, the U.S. government reacted by looking for ringleaders related to the outbreak and actions that took place in its wake. This resulted in Alchese's arrest and the execution of 3 scouts, along with the imprisonment of a few others, a state of affairs which lasted for several months. Finally, the October 24, 1882 edition of Tucson's Arizona Star reported the findings of a federal grand jury condemning conditions at San Carlos and the treatment of Alchese and 10 of his fellow prisoners who were held in confinement by the Indian agent for a period of 14 months without even presenting a charge against them. Their release followed. Alchese was back on the reservation after George Crook, now a brigadier general, again held the reins of the Department of Arizona. Making his fact-finding rounds, Crook included Fort Apache, where he conferred with Alchese and scores of others. The one-time scout and Pedro both questioned why military authority on the reservation had given way to civilians from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. This change eventually ignited a powder keg of distrust and violence because of the supposed mismanagement and duplicity of the Indian agents and their cavalier approach to whites encroaching on the reservation. Airing his grievances along with those of many gathered there, Alchese was content to again throw in his lot with Crook and the army. In 1883, when the general headed into the wilds of the Sierra Madre in Mexico, Alchese rode with the punitive expedition seeking Chirachua Apaches, accused of constant raids on both sides of the border. Again, John Burke noted Alchese among those Indians who were all tried and true men, experienced in warfare, and devoted to the general whose standard they followed. Once more in 1885, Alchese joined Crook for his foray against Geronimo. After months of rugged campaigning, Geronimo agreed to meet with Crook. By March 22, 1885, the general dispatched Alchese and a handful of scouts in advance to the designated meeting place, where after his arrival, he assigned another mission. Alchese and Cayenne Tena, a one-time so-called Bronco Apache who had opposed Crook in 1883, to make talk with several of the prominent men among the Chirachuas. They were to speak for peace and abandonment of Geronimo if he persisted in fighting. The next day, Crook met with these headmen along with Geronimo. One of them, Chief Chihuahua, concluded his long diatribe with the words, "I think a great deal of Alchese and Cayentena. They think a great deal of me." Then he expressed a wish that they could end the war and exist as friends and in brotherhood. In due course, Geronimo had his say to Crook, ending with, "I surrender myself to you. I want now to let Alchese and Cayentena to speak a few words." The latter spokesperson indicated that Alchese would represent both of them, which he did succinctly. He urged Crook to hold no bad feelings toward his former foes. He indicated that they all wanted the general to be in charge of us and no one else. You know me well. I have never told a lie, nor have you ever told me a lie, and now I tell you that these Chiricahua really want to do what is right and live at peace. Regrettably, while Alchise's words rang true, Geronimo and a small number of holdouts reneged on the desire to halt hostilities. They bolted, most probably to Alchise's chagrin. He had pledged his honor on their behalf, something he took most seriously. Not until September 1886 did the bloodshed end after a conference with Geronimo at Skeleton Canyon. Having served faithfully, Alchise left the scouts. He took up ranching near the North Fork of the White River. During the decades that followed, he made several trips to Washington, D.C. to meet with presidents and other officials as a champion for the rights of his people. He also advocated education, and he converted to Christianity. In the process, he developed a staunch relationship with the Reverend Edgar Gunther and his family at the nearby Lutheran mission. Toward the end of Alchise's remarkable existence of nearly eight decades, the Holbrook News for October 20th, 1922 observed, "Alchise is an old man and has seen great changes during his lifetime." The article added, "He is a man of remarkable character, and it is seldom you find one who can speak with equal sententiousness, be they white or red. Asked once years ago what he thought of the rough country around Fort Apache, he said, 'Well, God made the country, so it's all right. But if the white man had made it, we would never have forgiven him.'" Alchise died on August 6, 1928. A headstone in the White River Cemetery on the Fort Apache Reservation, bearing the image of a Medal of Honor, marks the grave of this remarkable role model. Arguably, the more fitting tribute than the one attesting to his valor is the high school that bears his name. His passion for education, untiring efforts to benefit his people, and willingness to adapt bespeak an extraordinary man for all seasons. John Langlier's numerous publications include American Indians and the U.S. Army Forces, 1866 to 1945. Tragic Powwow, True West, September 2020, by Bob Bowes Bell. June 1st, 1887. The Indians know by motions, we know by signs. Antonio reached out his hand and made a circle in his hand and spoke in Apache at the same time. He said that the five scouts will be sent down to the islands. Chief Gonshayi, an eyewitness to the fight, who testifies that Antonio Diaz's sign conveyed to the Indians that the scouts would be sent to Alcatraz or Florida, which triggered the shootout. Absent from military duty for 5 days, the Apache Kid, along with four other Apache scouts under his command, ride single file into the Arizona headquarters of the San Carlos Reservation. The Kid was acting chief of scouts, while Al Sieber was away at Fort Apache and the White River Sub-Agency. Upon his return to San Carlos, Sieber has summoned the Kid after hearing he killed another Apache in an alcohol-fueled family feud. Told by a messenger that the Kid wants to powwow, Sieber contacts the commanding officer, Captain Francis Pierce. Two interpreters are also notified. The clock is approaching 5 p.m. as Sieber and Pierce proceed 75 yards on foot from headquarters to Sieber's tent to meet the party. Although the Kid and his men are carrying their arms openly, in direct violation of camp regulations, none of the men in Sieber's party is armed. As word of the scouts' arrival spreads, other Apaches from the nearby camps gravitate toward the tent, and some of them are armed. Walking up to the scouts, Sieber says, "Hello, Kid." Returning the greeting, the Apache Kid and his scouts dismount with their weapons in their hands. Captain Pierce asks, "Where are the five scouts who have been absent?" The Apache Kid and the others step forward. "Give me your rifle," Pierce orders the Kid. The kid complies. Pierce demands his gun belt, which the kid surrenders. The captain places the rifle against Seaver's tent and gun belt in a chair. He orders the other four to give up their arms and gun belts, which they do. Pointing in the direction of the guardhouse, Captain Pierce barks, "Calaboose!" Spanglish for jail. Several of the Indians pick up their gun belts and remove their knife scabbards. Pierce and Seaver hear an unusual commotion. They turn to see mounted Indians loading their rifles. The assembled Apaches later claim one of the interpreters, Antonio Diaz, had intimated with Apache sign that the arrested scouts would be sent to the island, which signifies Alcatraz, or even Florida. Several of the disarmed scouts lunge for their weapons as Pierce jumps in between them, trying to shove their guns out of reach. The kid makes a grab for his carbine, but Seaver grabs it with his right hand while shoving Kid with his left. Unable to retrieve his weapon, the kid runs around the tent and disappears. "Look out, Seaver!" Pierce yells. "They are going to shoot!" Seaver kicks the guns toward the tent as two shots ring out, one right after the other. Seaver and Pierce dive into the tent as bullets rip through the twin openings from front to back. Seaver grabs his weapon and runs out to engage the shooters. He fires at a mounted Apache who has just fired at him. But before Seaver can fire again, a 45-70 slug tears into his left leg below the knee, breaking the bone and knocking him flat. He crawls back into the tent as the Apaches disappear into the twilight. The unexpected gunfight is over, but the long, tragic nightmare of the Apache kid has just begun. Aftermath, odds and ends. On the run for 24 days, the Apache kid surrenders, and he's found guilty and sentenced to death by his firing squad, but General Nelson Miles objects and intervenes, reducing the kid's sentence to 10 years at Alcatraz. After serving 16 months in the federal prison, the kid is released on a technicality and returns to the San Carlos Reservation in Arizona. Soon, though, civilians led by Al Seaver press for new charges, and the kid is then sentenced to 7 years at Yuma Territorial Prison. In transit and under guard, the kid escapes and is never caught by the authorities. Some historians believe that the kid escaped into the Sierra Madre Mountains in Old Mexico, where he lived out his life. Others believe he was killed in a shootout with Mormon settlers in Chihuahua in 1900. In 1937, Norwegian explorer and anthropologist Helge Ingstad heard that renegade Apaches still lived in Mexico. Traveling deep into the Sierra Madre, Ingstad claimed he found a woman, Lupe, who was thought to be the daughter of the Apache kid. Now I'm going to go back to True West February 2019's edition to read a related story to the previous article. The Final Nail in the Apache Kid's Coffin by Linda A. Sanchez. Everyone in the posse took notice of a pair of binoculars taken from the Apache's body. The Apache Kid always carried them from the time he was a scout, and no other Sierra Madre Apache had been found with them. Only a few leaders, including Geronimo, had access to field glasses. The year was not 1886, however, and the surrender was long past. It was November 11th, 1900, and yet another encounter with renegade Apaches by Mormon settlers had played out with bad luck for those who rode with El Chitivo's band. The Apache Kid Identified. The New York Times reported the Apache Kid's demise on November 23rd. President Joseph F. Smith of the Mormon Church, who has arrived here accompanied by A.O. Woodruff and other church elders after a tour among the colonies in Mexico, reports the killing of the notorious Apache Kid in the recent Indian raid in Colonia Pacheco. Posse members agreed that the fallen leader was the Apache Kid. The Clough brothers, Mormon President Anthony Ivins, and church elder Orson Pratt Brown had either seen the Apache Kid at San Carlos or had viewed wanted posters of him. President Ivins had plans to claim the reward. Brown captured the scene on film, writing, "I had taken my camera with me, and I took a photograph of the Indian chief. He had been shot through the nipple, and the bullet came out his back left side." Yet no bounty was ever collected. No photos were ever found. Without proof, the death of the Apache Kid appeared to be an impossible dream, despite the posse's visits to the San Carlos Apache Reservation in Arizona Territory to claim their reward. Nevertheless, the men believed they had gotten their man, the Apache who murdered members of the Thompson family in 1892 and rode roughshod for years over settlers in the rugged Sierra Madre Mountains and along the restless U.S.-Mexico borderlands. Unintended consequences. Journals and letters compiled by the men who participated in what they considered the final death throes of one of the Southwest's most destructive and hated outlaws were amazingly detailed. "We have made preparations to go in the morning to dispose of the dead and see if we can find any more Apaches alive," wrote Woodruff in November 1900. Based on a comparison of the participants' accounts, here is how the event unfolded. The Apache Kid was often seen haunting rugged mountain trails along both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border after his 1889 escape from a wagon loaded with other Apaches on the way to Yuma Prison in Arizona Territory. He reportedly had been killed at least 18 times over many years. Despite being accused of heinous crimes, the Apache Kid had the audacity to visit his family from time to time at the San Carlos Reservation. After 1900, though, sightings of the Apache Kid were basically non-existent. Yet not even the Apache Kid was gifted with the nine lives of a cat. He was flesh and blood. He cared about his family. He was incredibly brave and fiendishly clever. And he outsmarted just about everyone until that cold November day in 1900. Despite the supposed end of the Apache Wars in 1886, times were hard in Colonia Pacheco, as in all the Mormon colonies of Sonora and Chihuahua in Mexico. Although known as a loner, the Apache Kid learned he could work with other Apaches to steal more supplies to meet the band's needs. While Mormon settlers were out in the fields or attending church meetings on November 11th, the Apaches struck quickly, stealing hundreds of pounds of potatoes and corn, livestock, blankets, and other household items. Winter was coming soon, and that food belonged to Mormon families. Enough was enough. Ranchers Martin Harris and Thomas Allen were at first unsure of the bandits' identities. The thieves might have also been dangerous renegade Mexicans from Dos Cabezas mines, who, like the Apaches, also raided Mormon colonies and isolated ranches. They would follow the thieves and then make their report to church elders. Anger simmering, the two men threw caution to the wind and rode after the bandits, running into a buzzsaw of unintended consequences. They spotted the Apaches breaking camp. At least nine were well-armed, led by a warrior dressed in buckskin, a feathered war cap adorned with silver beads and trophies around his wrist and neck. The leader, carrying field glasses and a rifle, motioned for the others to head out. Harris and Allen barely had time to hide behind some rock outcroppings before the Apaches unexpectedly headed toward them. A woman in the lead shouted in alarm and tried to turn her horse around. Except for the warrior leader, the band scattered, as was Apache custom. The leader, carrying a child strapped to his back, responded to the woman's cry by grabbing for his rifle from the scabbard. It would not release. In desperation, he pulled again. Harris and Allen fired off enough shots to kill the woman and then turned their attention to the man who was furiously trying to detach the rifle. Too late. Bullets hit him twice, and he fell from his horse. One of the bullets also killed the girl on his back. Harris later admitted how bothered he was that they had killed an innocent child. The stunned and lucky ranchers rode back to Pacheco and reported the altercation. The frontier-tough Mormon elders sent runners to other communities to warn them of raiders. Then, both men took a posse to where the killings had taken place. Was the dead man the Apache Kid? It happened to my lot to come onto the first two Indians lying together dead, Woodruff recorded in his journal. I passed over them without saying anything, and next found a full quiver with 60 well-made arrows in it and a fine bow also. After the ground for some distance around had been searched to be sure there were no live Apaches in the bush, we took off the belts, pistols, moccasins, and the chief's cap, then found a good deep crevice in the rocks. These Indians were all well clad in native attire. The chief wore a belt filled with 45-70 shells. The squaw carried a knife, pistol, and many trinkets. The little one had a knife in the belt. They were the most savage-looking group I have ever seen. We followed the trail of those who escaped, but did not find them nor their tracks. We returned to the Harris Ranch, had a dance, and spent the night. Another description by Anthony Ivins revealed a man who took great pride in his appearance, even as he was living a dangerous hit-and-run existence. The man wore a skull cap made from heavy buckskin, with a strip under the chin, on each side of which were small horn-like projections to which tufts of eagle feathers were attached. A silver crescent with a piece of polished turquoise in the center adorned the front, while at the sides and behind were ornaments of polished stone and silver. Around his neck, attached to a string of beads, were a small Catholic cross and a Freemason's cross. The latter had contained an inscription, but the letters had been obliterated. He wore a tight-fitting shirt, underneath which, strapped to his body, was a pair of French field glasses. Belt, knife, case, pouches, and moccasins, and other accoutrements were all Indian-made and showed excellent workmanship. Buried twice. This macabre incident also included the posse burying the three Apaches twice, not to please the Mormon elders, but to appease Mexican officials who wanted to make sure that no Mexicans had been killed by these gringos who lived among them. On November 22nd, the headlines declared, "Killed in fight with Mormons. Apache Kid meets his death. A.O. Woodruff present at his burial." The posse placed a blanket in a crevice, Woodruff recounted, and laid the body of the leader first. They placed the girl at his feet and the female over both of them. They then respectfully added a blanket over the three bodies and then piled rocks 3 feet high on top. The posse then checked the countryside for additional sign of Apaches or supplies. They located one stolen horse and saddle. The remainder of the band had escaped into the depths of the Sierra Madre Mountains. Mexican officials from Casas Grandes met with the Mormons at the burial site. The Mexicans removed the rocks and the blankets, divulging that the reports were true. One Mexican official said, "Yes, they are savage Indians." After the grisly review, more individuals from the colonias examined the bodies. They agreed that the one appearing to be the leader was the elusive Apache Kid. Several of the men had freighted to and from San Carlos and had seen the young man while he was a scout at San Carlos. Others had observed his picture on the many wanted posters. President Ivins also identified the slain warrior as being the Apache Kid, and Woodruff noted in his diary that the two planned to report the affair to Captain Nicholson at San Carlos. The posse reburied the bodies. President Ivins later wrote about the killing of the Apache Kid. "He killed Mormons, and by Mormons was killed." The Apaches undoubtedly viewed their dead leader as a brave combatant fighting for the survival of his band in the only way he knew how. Was the dead man the Apache Kid? The residents of the Sierra Madre Mountains, who dealt with Apache raids for years, believed so. The inventory. The list of items the posse took from the Apaches is not the story of a ragtag Apache remnants known to haunt the Sierra Madre Cordillera between Sonora and Chihuahua in Mexico. These Broncos wore beautifully tanned buckskin, rode stolen horses, and were well-armed. But fate had turned against them that winter. The inventory items received by Mexican officials in Casas Grandes read like a mini-exhibit of Sierra Madre Apache artifacts. Whatever happened to them, no one knows. Officials perhaps kept them as souvenirs. An inventory item that jumps out at researchers are the French binoculars carried by the dead leader, believed to be the Apache Kid. The Apache Kid was photographed with his famed field glasses. At some point in his scouting career, Kid began carrying binoculars on a long shoulder strap, noted Phyllis de la Garza in her biography of the Apache Kid. Here is the inventory list. Binoculars, bow, quiver, and 40-60. Moccasins, well made. Three knives. Cartridge belts with 45-70 ammo. Rifle. Colt revolver with pearl handle. Bracelets. Medicine belt taken from the dead woman with roots and herbs attached. Saddle, found later on a missing horse the Apaches left behind. Various trinkets, string of silver beads and feathered war cap with silver crescent and turquoise stone in the middle. Knife cases and leather pouches of excellent craftsmanship. Two crosses, Catholic and Masonic. Linda A. Sanchez wishes to thank genealogist William S. Bryan for his special assistance. Sanchez will publish a more detailed discussion of these never-before-published accounts in her manuscript on the Lost Apaches. Now, returning to the True West September 2020 edition. Tombstone, Arizona, by Peter Corbett. Stagecoaches are running. Gunfighters are shooting it out with blanks. And Tombstone saloons are slinging drinks across the bar like they've been doing for nearly 140 years. The southeastern Arizona town's early mining boom was flooded out within two decades. The Spanish flu took its toll with hundreds of deaths a century ago, and Tombstone was so stagnant during the Great Depression that cattle wandered freely on Allen Street in front of empty shops. So this past year's two-month shutdown for COVID-19 was just the latest setback for a town whose too-tough-to-die motto is a badge of honor worn proudly. Still, it hurt when Wyatt Earp days were canceled over Memorial Day weekend on the heels of a two-thirds drop in spring tourism revenue. Action has returned to Tombstone's dusty streets. By early summer, SUVs and pickups from California, New Mexico, Texas, Nevada, and Arizona were rolling in on weekends, with visitors ready to kick up their boot heels. A cowboy singer played his old Kalamazoo guitar outside Old West Books. And optimistic Tombstone volunteers are planning to stage the town's biggest annual event, El Dorado Days, October 16th through the 18th. We're trying to make it as safe and friendly as possible, Mayor Dusty Escupule said of accommodating visitors and disinfecting public spaces. You can only hold an American down for so long when they're going to start fighting and want to get up and go somewhere. Mayor Escupule, a fourth-generation Tombstone native and sixth-term mayor, has been running stagecoaches in town for a quarter century. Any bucket list trip to Tombstone includes a visit to the OK Corral for a reenactment of the famous gunfight of October 26, 1881. Lawmen Wyatt, Virgil, and Morgan Earp were joined by Doc Holliday in a shootout that killed Tom and Frank McLaurie and Billy Clanton, while Ike Clayton and Billy Claiborne fled. Virgil and Morgan Earp and Holliday were wounded. You can read all about it in a replica front page of the tombstone epitaph from the day after the gunfight. Detailed exhibits explaining the OK Corral gun battle are on display at the Tombstone Courthouse State Historic Park on Toughnut and 3rd Streets. On unpaved Allen Street, the 1881 Birdcage Theater is a frozen-in-time glimpse of a frontier den of wickedness where gamblers played and prostitutes pocketed some of their poker winnings. If those walls could talk, well, the many bullet holes in the walls say plenty about the Birdcage. Early Tombstone had as many as 110 licensed liquor establishments when it was one of the Arizona Territory's largest towns. Today, thirsty visitors can imbibe and dine at the 1879 Crystal Palace, with its elegant back bar and Big Nose Kate Saloon. It's named for Mary Catherine Haroney, a one-time prostitute and companion of Doc Holliday. Susan Wallace, Tombstone Chamber President and the owner of Big Nose Kate's, touted the town's many attractions, including an underground mine tour, narrated stagecoach and trolley rides, and a bonanza of Allen Street shops. People think you can pass through Tombstone in an afternoon, and you certainly can, she said. But there's so much more to it when you start looking around. Where else can you see the world's largest rose tree, planted in 1885? Don't miss the Ed Schieffelin Monument, a six-mile drive west on Allen Street. He was the popular 1870s prospector who was warned the only thing he'd find in Apache country was his tombstone. But Schieffelin proved the naysayers and assayers wrong, striking it rich with the Lucky Cuss and Tough Nut Mines in 1879. Schieffelin was tough, and so is Tombstone. "Hey, we're still here," Wallace said. "We are too tough to die. We're very resilient." Peter Corbett moved west to Flagstaff in 1974 to attend Northern Arizona University, where he studied English and American Studies. He's been exploring Arizona and the West since then and had a 35 career in Arizona journalism. The Humble Biscuit, True West, September 2020, by Sherry Monahan. The Humble Biscuit quieted the growls of many hungry pioneer stomachs and sometimes served as their only meal. Biscuits were enjoyed with butter, honey, jam, or gravy, and served in Nebraska sod houses, fancy frontier hotels, and along dusty cattle drives. Even though most pioneers enjoyed biscuits, none were more particular about them than the cowboys. Their chuck wagon cook was either loved or hated based on the quality of his biscuits. The good ones were called dough gods, while the bad ones were called belly cheaters. A scene from Lonesome Dove captured the pride and appreciation for a good biscuit maker. McMurtry's character, Jake, asks Gus, "What'd it take to get you to whip up another batch of them biscuits? I've come all the way from Arkansas without tasting a good bite of bread." A real frontier biscuit maker named McMillan, Mac, hired on with an outfit near Venta, Oklahoma in 1882 as their cook. According to the article, The Fighting Cook, in the June 29, 1891 San Francisco Call, he was their sixth cook in 6 weeks because the cowboys were rough and mean as they drove the cattle to Kansas. One morning, the men started harassing Mac about the pork and coffee as he made breakfast, but he ignored them. The biggest man in camp was Joe Taylor, who told Mac he had better improve his biscuits by the noon meal or else. Mac's pipe dropped from his mouth, but he let Taylor finish his rant. He then calmly walked over to the wagon and returned with his Colt revolvers. With a wicked look in his eyes, he shouted at Taylor, "You ain't got no appetite, but you sit down and eat all them biscuits, or I'll plug you before you can wink. Eat them biscuits!" Taylor ate the entire pan and could barely move as the other cowboys chuckled. Mac then said, "I thought you would soon find your appetite." He then turned to the rest of the cowboys to inquire how they liked their coffee and pork. They unanimously agreed that his cooking was just fine. Biscuits came in other varieties and were made with baking soda, baking powder, or various forms of yeast. The flour used on the frontier was far different from what's used today. Today's biscuits are white, soft, and fluffy, but that's not exactly what they were like in the 1800s. Common wheats of the time included Sonora, Red Fife, and Turkey Red, which was milled into flour and used to make biscuits and other baked goods. Flour was sometimes sifted to achieve a smooth consistency, but that was usually done for certain recipes, like light cakes and soft breads. It wasn't until the late 1800s that flour started becoming refined and stripped of its flavorful and healthy bran and the germ. Women bakers scoffed at it in the beginning because the flour had no taste, and they added flavorings to their baked goods. If you want to make biscuits like the pioneers did, get some historic flours like Sonora or Turkey Red from Barton Springs Mill in Texas, Bolted Turkey or Golden Buffalo from Heartland Mill in Kansas, Red Fife from Comas Country Mill in Oregon, Sonora or Artesian from historic Hayden Mills in Arizona, or use modern-day flour from the historic War Eagle Mill in Arkansas. Frontier biscuits. 3 cups flour, 4 teaspoons baking powder, 1 teaspoon salt, 1 tablespoon sugar, 6 tablespoons butter, cold, 1 to 1 and 1/4 cups milk. Combine dry ingredients in a bowl and stir to mix. Cut the butter into the flour until it becomes pea-sized. Stir in the milk just enough to combine, but don't overmix. If the dough seems too dry, add 1 tablespoon of flour at a time. Turn out onto a floured surface and roll to 1-inch thickness. Cut into biscuit shapes and place on a baking sheet. Bake at 425 degrees for about 15 to 20 minutes or until golden. Recipe adapted from Kansas's Republic County Pilot, July 16, 1885. Now here's the column by Marshall Trimble from True West, September 2020. Working Cowboys, Wyatt Earp, and Big Nose Kate. Did all cowboys carry guns? Rendell Jones, Purpurlini, Pontypool, Mouth Monkshire, Wales, United Kingdom. Not all of them packed iron. A pistol could get in the way of roping and branding. So if a cowboy owned one, it would often be stowed in their war sacks or bags. A pistol was a handy thing to have for varmints, human and otherwise. Usually when a cowboy came to town, he'd have to check his gun at the hotel, livery stable, or the marshal's office. Was scurvy common in the Old West? John Volz, LaGrange, Kentucky. Scurvy is caused by a lack of vitamin C. Canned tomatoes, common on cattle drives, contained enough vitamin C to prevent scurvy. Wagon trains had a variety of fruits that also provided vitamin C, so the condition was not common in the Old West. What is known about Joseph Antrim, Marine Hagler, Sacramento, California? Truth is, we don't know for certain if Joe was older or younger than Billy. We also don't know if they were full brothers or half brothers. The only photo of Joe with provenances of him and an old man. He spent most of his adult life in Colorado as a gambler. Reportedly, he met Pat Garrett after Billy was killed, and the two left on a fairly friendly note. He died penniless in Denver in 1930. He donated his body to a medical school. What was the cost of a stagecoach trip in the Old West? Evaldo Munoz Braz, Curitiba, state of Paraná, Brazil. All stagecoach riders paid a price in physical discomfort, lack of sleep, bad food, and unfriendly elements. As far as fare went, short trips were charged 10 to 15 cents per mile. The cost for the 2,812-mile journey from Tipton, Missouri to San Francisco, California was $200, and that didn't cover the $1 meals. Another source says a ticket cost $15 for 100 miles and another $5 if you had a trunk. What contributed to Wyatt Earp's success in dealing with other folks? Greg Tannheimer, Peoria, Arizona. Wyatt seemed to have a presence about him that said, "Don't trifle with me." He was steady, brave, didn't drink much, nor talk much. He could fight with his fists or his smoke wagon. Maybe the most important of all is he was tall. The average male was about 5'7". Wyatt was 6 feet tall. Did Big Nose Kate ever do any writing or interviews? Steve Williams, Scottsdale, Arizona. Kate, Haroni, Fisher, Melvin, Elder, Holiday, Cummings, Howard, worked off and on as a freelance prostitute. She had a long and volatile relationship with Doc Holiday. Following a drunken fight with Doc, she accused him of being a member of the gang that robbed the Benson stage. She sobered up and repudiated her statement, but the damage was done. The love story ended a few months before the famous gunfight. Apparently, Kate, there's no evidence she was called Big Nose during her lifetime, took copious notes of her adventures with a lot of embellishments added. For example, she claimed to have been an eyewitness to the gunfight behind the OK Corral. Researcher Ann Collier says that in the years preceding her death, Kate was going by the name Mary Cummings. She met with authors Albert Bork and Anton Mazovanich in hopes of having a biography written. But she confused many dates and places and offered only vague clues of her own past. This caused some to question if Mary was really Kate. She petitioned Arizona Governor George Hunt, a longtime friend, to be admitted to the Arizona Pioneers Home in Prescott in 1931. She died there November 2, 1940, just a few days short of her 90th birthday. Author Craig Ince did write her story in According to Kate, The Legendary Life of Big Nose Kate, Love of Doc Holiday, published in 2019 by Two Dot. Zebulon Pike's Life on the Mississippi, True West, September 2020, by Johnny D. Boggs. If William Clark and Meriwether Lewis are the Yankees and Dodgers of American West explorers, then Zebulon Montgomery Pike has to be the St. Louis Cardinals. I can't believe I just wrote that. I hate the Yankees, and I rarely root for the post-Brooklyn Dodgers or the Cardinals, though it's hard to find a better baseball team than St. Louis. Kansas City still has better barbecue. Zeb Pike seemed an unlikely choice to lead an expedition up America's best-known river or have a Colorado mountain named after him. Born in Lamberton, New Jersey in 1779, Zeb came from a sickly family. Four of his siblings died young. Three others contracted tuberculosis. Zeb's soldier father moved the family west after the Revolutionary War to Pennsylvania and Ohio, where Zeb joined the army at age 15. General James Wilkinson took a liking to the boy, promoting Zeb to lieutenant, then summoning him to St. Louis to send him up the Mississippi. Our river trip begins in St. Louis, too, with history stops at Jefferson Barracks Park, Gateway Arch National Park, and, of course, Fort Bellefontaine. On August 9, 1805, Zeb and 20 others left the new fort, the first U.S. military installation west of the Mississippi River, now a county park. Zeb didn't know it at the time, but when they launched the 70-foot keelboat, he was also launching his way to fame. Wilkinson's reasons for ordering the mission are unclear. Zeb's orders were basically to find the river's source, make notes of distances and geography, investigate the fur trade, find possible sites for military bases, make peace with Indian tribes, and collect plant and animal specimens. But Wilkinson didn't have a sterling reputation. Historian W.E. Holland called Wilkinson vain, bombastic, and incompetent, and a master of petty treason with a gift of scandal. if Wilkinson played baseball, he would have been a Houston Astro. My Major League Baseball comparison doesn't quite work, but not because the game wasn't around in 1805. Major League? This appears to be Class A ball. No one thought to assign a doctor to this corps, or an interpreter to make those Indian negotiations productive. Zeb did have a device to determine latitude, along with the watch and thermometer, all the scientific instruments one needs for such an endeavor. He brought along some hunting dogs, and better yet, whiskey. Best guess is that the government spent roughly $2,000 to equip Zeb's crew, just a tad less than the Kansas City Royals' annual payroll. Zeb's men had to drag that keelboat over sandbars on their way north, and Zeb was not the patient type. Near present-day Muscatine, Iowa, after losing two of his hunting dogs, Zeb left behind the dogs and the two soldiers who volunteered to look for them. Helped by a Scottish trader and an Indian, the men caught up with Zeb near Dubuque, Iowa. The dogs remained AWOL. While much of Zeb's trip is overlooked today, Old West history flows along both shores of the river. There's Hannibal, Missouri. Mark Twain, Boyhood Home and Museum, Hannibal History Museum. Because who can travel the Mississippi without thinking about Samuel Clemens? There's Nauvoo, Illinois. Several Latter-day Saint sites. Once called the Kingdom of Pike. There's Fort Madison, Iowa. Home of Old Fort Madison, established in 1808 to protect the new Louisiana Territory. There's LeClaire, Iowa, where Zeb's boys camped April 24th, and where a historical marker commemorates pre-Buffalo Bill William F. Cody's birth in 1845. The farmhouse Cody's father built in 1847 has been restored near Princeton, and to keep our baseball theme going, the Field of Dreams movie site is a tad inland near Dyersville. 2 miles south of McGregor, Iowa, Pike's Peak State Park brings us back to our subject. Pike found this spot at the mouth of the Wisconsin River in September 1805. Iowa's Pike's Peak, by the way, is a 500-foot bluff. Call it 1,112 feet in elevation, a tad under Colorado's 14,114 feet summit. Pike recommended the location as a possible military site, but the Army picked nearby Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, where the Fort Crawford Museum honors the two forts operating here from 1816 to 1856. When Zeb reached present-day Minneapolis-St. Paul, Fort Snelling State Park, Minnesota History Center, he noted that the hills, valleys, and trees were sometimes interrupted by a wide, extended plain. With snow falling in October, Zeb's party stopped near Little Falls, Minnesota, Charles A. Weyerhaeuser Memorial Museum, to build a winter stockade. Sleds and legs took the party north to Brainerd, Crow Wing County Museum, and Grand Rapids, Judy Garland Museum. And finally, on February 1st, Zeb discovered the Mississippi source at what is now Cass Lake. Only the Mississippi source is 25 miles west at Lake Itasca. Well, it's not like Zeb was good at finding where rivers begin. Where do the Mississippi and Red River begin? That's what Zebulon Pike was ordered to find out in 1805 and 1806. Western Writers Hall of Fame member Will Bagley says. He got close, but didn't find either. He did find the sources of the South Platte, built a fort on the Rio Grande, and discovered Grand, now Pike's, Peak, before he disappeared into the shadow of his fellow adventurers, Lewis and Clark. The boys began their return home on April 8th, arriving 3 weeks later, after covering more than 2,000 miles in 264 days. Although his mission was mostly successful, he failed at locating the exact beginning of the Mississippi, says James A. Crutchfield, another historian in the Western Writers Hall of Fame. He did, however, obtain from the natives a large tract of land surrounding the Falls of St. Anthony, which eventually became the site of the massive Fort Snelling, and later, the cities of Minneapolis-St. Paul. Zeb would be little remembered today as an explorer if he was judged solely by the Mississippi Expedition in 1805-6, Holland wrote in a 1949 article for the Wisconsin Magazine of History. But Zeb's life on the Mississippi helped him in the end. Says Crutchfield, the leadership, wilderness, and negotiating skills that Pike developed on this nearly nine-month-long journey well prepared him for his second foray into the western wilderness, to the frontier of New Mexico and beyond, the mission for which he will always be remembered, and which ensured his legacy as one of the foremost of American explorers.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the coronavirus update at 1. Texas began as a distinctive place, and it remains so today. In 1973, Texas Monthly Magazine was founded to cover all aspects of the Texas lifestyle. Each week, Recording Library of West Texas volunteers and staff dig through the files of the National Magazine of Texas to bring you Texas Monthly Archives. You'll hear biographical articles about some of the most fascinating Texans, feature stories covering interesting places and things in Texas, and short pieces that are humorous and thought-provoking. Tune in to hear these stories covering contemporary Texas from the 70s, 80s, and 90s that would otherwise be lost to time. Texas Monthly Archives, Thursday nights at 7, Sunday afternoons at 2, and Mondays at midnight on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 82 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 70s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour. Readings of books from all genres, handpicked by staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hachette Audio presents The Bridges of Madison County, written by Robert James Waller. Read by Kelly O'Hara and Stephen Pasquale.
Francesca, give me the camera with the blue strap, please. She opened the knapsack, feeling a little overcautious about the expensive equipment he handled so casually, and took out the camera. It said Nikon on the chrome plating of the viewfinder, with an F to the upper left of the name. He was on his knees northeast of the bridge, with the tripod low. He held out his left hand without taking his eye from the viewfinder, and she gave him the camera, watching his hand close about the lens as he felt it touch him. He worked the plunger on the end of the cord she had seen hanging out of his vest yesterday. The shutter fired. He cocked the shutter and fired again. He reached under the tripod head and unscrewed the camera on it, which was replaced by the one she had given him. While he fastened on the new one, he turned his head toward her and grinned. "Thanks. You're a first-class assistant." She flushed a little. God, what was it about him? He was like some star creature who had drafted in on the tail of a comet and dropped off at the end of her lane. Why can't I just say you're welcome, she thought. I feel sort of slow around him. Though it's nothing he does. It's me, not him. I'm just not used to being with people whose minds work as fast as his does. He moved into the creek, then up the other bank. She went through the bridge with the blue knapsack and stood behind him, happy, strangely happy. There was energy here, a power of some kind in the way he worked. He didn't just wait for nature, he took it over in a gentle way, shaping it to his vision, making it fit what he saw in his mind. He imposed his will on the scene, countering changes in light with different lenses, different films, a filter occasionally. He didn't just fight back, he dominated, using skill and intellect. Farmers also dominated the land with chemicals and bulldozers. But Robert Kincaid's way of changing nature was elastic and always left things in their original form when he finished. She looked at the jeans pulling themselves tight around his thigh muscles as he knelt down, at the faded denim shirt sticking to his back, gray hair over the collar of it, at how he sat back on his haunches to adjust a piece of equipment, and for the first time in ever so long, she grew wet between her legs just watching someone. When she felt it, she looked up at the evening sky and breathed deeply, listening to him quietly curse a jammed filter that wouldn't unscrew from a lens. He crossed the creek again back toward the trucks, sloshing along in his rubber boots. Francesca went into the covered